I think that the administration is very serious about holding China's feet to the fire here.
That is the opinion of the U.S.-China Business Council. We'll have more on that in a moment. This is Thursday, May 9th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, we take a closer look as to why the U.S. has remained optimistic about a deal with North Korea. You get a look at Ramadan in the United States, and Rohingya refugee camps in Bangladesh could be in trouble because of Mother Nature. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Chinese Vice President Liu He arrives in Washington this week for trade talks as the United States prepares to raise tariffs on Chinese goods in the middle of his visit. The U.S. will boost tariffs from 10 to 25% on $200 billion worth of Chinese imports on Friday. That according to a notice published Wednesday in the Federal Register from the U.S. Trade Representative's office. This increase takes effect on the second day of Liu's visit, but won't dampen hopes for an agreement, at least in the mind of U.S. President Donald Trump. In a Twitter post, the U.S. president says China has just informed us that they are now coming to the U.S. to make a deal. Trump said he would be happy to maintain tariffs on Chinese imports and added that Beijing would be mistaken if it hopes to negotiate trade later with a Democratic presidential administration. The Chinese Commerce Ministry reacted to the announced tariff increase, vowing to take necessary countermeasures if the tax is implemented. The ministry said escalating trade tensions are not beneficial to either country or to the world. Trump set the new Friday deadline to raise tariffs after the U.S. accused China of reneging earlier this week on commitments made during months of talks to end their trade war. The administration hopes the new tariffs will form changes in China's trade, subsidy, and intellectual property practices. The two sides have been unable to reach a deal due in part to differences over the enforcement of an agreement and a timeline for removing the tariffs. We welcome to VOA Asia Doug Barry, a spokesman for the U.S.-China Business Council. Doug, what's been your reaction to these threats of raising the tariffs by the United States?
It's certainly troubling, coming now as it is at the 11th hour when we expected that there would be an agreement between the parties this week with the vice premier's visit and the meetings that he's going to hold with the U.S. Negotiating team tomorrow and Friday here in Washington. At the same time, we're hopeful that a deal can still be worked out. We think it's in the best interest of both parties, and certainly our members would like to see the agreement in substance that has been hinted at over the last several weeks.
Why do you not agree with the president that tariffs are needed?
Well, we feel that there's still an opportunity to work out some of the issues that have been discussed in the press about why the additional tariffs have been threatened, and that is the backtracking, reneging, as you just mentioned it, on the drafts of the agreement that was previously negotiated. And this has to do with the U.S. side's insistence that the agreement be codified in national Chinese law. And that is done because the Trump administration feels that just leaving it up to administrative regulations is not going to be sufficient. And based on the track record of the Chinese government in the past, the feeling is there has to be a more formal process for implementing the various aspects of the agreement.
You speak for the U.S.-China Business Council. What kind of effect on U.S.-China business would the implementation of such tariff hikes implement?
Well, there's going to be a considerable additional burden of costs on U.S. companies that are operating in China and exporting products to the United States, as well as U.S. companies that are not operating in China but nevertheless have Chinese suppliers. The United States imports a substantial amount of goods from China, far more than China imports from the United States. And with those additional tariffs of 10 to 25%, the cost at the cash register for consumers who are buying products that are imported from China is going to go up. And no doubt it's going to pinch people's pocketbooks at the cash register, and it's probably going to lead to lower sales as these tariffs bite. And that's going to be bad for the companies, it's going to be bad for the people who work at the companies, and it's going to be bad for U.S. consumers who are going to have to pay a lot more for the products that they buy.
What are the products that would most likely be affected? Number one, if U.S. tariff increases go into effect, and number two, if China retaliates with similar tariff increases.
Yes, if China retaliates in a sort of a tit-for-tat manner, it's clear that U.S. agricultural products will be affected, along with other items that the U.S. exports, including telecommunications equipment, automobiles, and other manufactured goods that go from the United States to China.
And what about U.S. tariff increases? What kind of products are most affected?
Well, it will be products across the board. It will be, hundreds of different categories. It will be virtually everything that is now imported from China that was not part of the first round of tariffs. They will receive the 10 to 25% tariffs, and this will be a broad range of consumer goods, of including clothing items and textiles, and the day-to-day items that people buy at their Walmarts and other retail stores. U.S. consumers will notice that all of those prices in time will go up. The first round of tariffs that are in effect now, in many cases, the U.S. importer was able to cover those costs, that is, take a hit on their own profits, but not necessarily pass them on to U.S. consumers. That's about to change.
Do you think that President Trump continuing to reinforce the threat is just using it as that, a threat?
I don't think so. I think that the administration is very serious about holding China's feet to the fire here, and whatever they agreed to earlier in the negotiation process, they want to dissuade them from going back on it. So I think they're very serious about imposing these tariffs on additional Chinese goods and doing so on Friday at 1 minute after midnight.
Doug Barry is a spokesman for the U.S.-China Business Council here in Washington. These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. Officials in Afghanistan say a Taliban car bomb and gun attack against a U.S.-funded international relief organization Wednesday killed at least five people, including a police guard, and wounded 24 others. China is calling on all parties to uphold the Iranian nuclear pact after Tehran said it would end curbs on its uranium enrichment stockpile unless other powers helped it bypass renewed U.S. sanctions. Mount Sinabung erupts on Indonesian Sumatra Island, sending a massive column of ash and smoke into the air and coating local villages in debris. Same-sex marriage opponents gather outside Taiwan's parliament to protest the government's support for a bill which, if passed, would make it Asia's first gay marriage law. VOA Asia continues. The United States and South Korea have offered only a muted response to North Korea's first ballistic missile test in a year and a half. That's because both governments have incentives to make sure talks with North Korea are not derailed, as VOA's Bill Callow reports from Seoul.
For a year, U.S. President Donald Trump has insisted his nuclear talks with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un are progressing. His proof? No North Korean nuclear or missile tests.
Speed is not that important to me. I very much appreciate no testing, and I am in no rush. We don't want the testing, and we've developed something very special with respect to that.
Trump can't say that anymore. Last week, North Korea launched its first ballistic missile in a year and a half. The short-range missile launch is Kim's latest attempt to increase pressure on Trump, says Korea analyst Scott Snyder.
I do think the North Koreans are testing the U.S. response. They're trying to find out where the ceiling is in terms of U.S. tolerance for provocations.
Days after the launch, the White House response has still been muted. Trump hasn't even criticized the test. Other U.S. officials point out that the missile was not capable of hitting the U.S. mainland. But by trying to salvage the nuclear talks, the U.S. could actually be ensuring that North Korea tests more missiles.
The North Koreans may decide that they haven't hit the ceiling, and therefore there's a possibility that they will do more tests in order to try to define exactly how far they can go before the United States responds in a more dramatic fashion.
It's the natural outcome of Trump defining the success of the talks in terms of no North Korean tests, says La Trobe University's Benjamin Habib.
So he's really trapped in how he responds to this current escalation by the error he made there in not taking a more incremental approach. Clearly, any kind of test was going to, after that, is going to damage Trump. And it's going to make him harder. It's going to make it harder for him to come back and negotiate again.
South Korea has also responded cautiously, fearful of ruining talks that President Moon Jae-in has made a centerpiece of his administration.
Here in South Korea, many officials are reluctant to even utter the word missile. Instead, they prefer now to say that North Korea tested projectiles. That is partly explained by the fact that South Korea could be most impacted if Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un begin once again exchanging threats of nuclear war. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Happening now in Asia, a Pakistani Christian woman who faced execution for blasphemy against Islam has reportedly left the country. News of Asiya Bibi's departure was reported Wednesday by various Pakistani news outlets, while Reuters says it's learned from her lawyer that she has left for Canada, where her family has been granted asylum. Stay up to date with VOA. This is VOA Asia. As the Muslim holy month of Ramadan began this week, Muslim Americans of diverse backgrounds and national origins gathered in Islamic centers across the United States to break their dawn-to-dusk fast, perform congressional night prayers, and help the poor. President Donald Trump has sent warmest greetings to all Muslims observing what he called the holy month of Ramadan. The White House has been celebrating Ramadan since 1996, but President Thomas Jefferson hosted the first White House iftar dinner back in 1805. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi takes a look at Ramadan in America.
Perhaps nowhere in the world is the diversity among Muslims is represented than in the United States, where American Muslims have their roots in more than 50 countries around the world. Despite such diversity, during the month of Ramadan, their feeling of unity is especially strong. Imam Abdullah Khouj is president of the Islamic Center in Washington.
People from all around the world gather in one place, and we do all feel like we are one people, regardless of the distance and regardless of the geographical areas.
Muslims observe Ramadan with rituals that bridge many differences. Families shop for halal food, they prepare iftar dinners to break their daily fast, help the poor, and perform nightly prayers in mosques and Islamic centers. But Muslim Americans practice an extra ritual during Ramadan. Imam Shakir Sayyid is the president of Dar al-Hijra Islamic Center in Virginia.
We host iftar for non-Muslim neighbors right here in the mosque, and we reach out to non-Muslim organizations, churches, synagogues, and other civic organizations to tell them what Ramadan is about.
With the growing visibility and influence of Muslims in the American society, American presidents since President Bill Clinton in 1996 have sent Muslims Ramadan greetings and invited their leaders to White House for an iftar dinner. President Donald Trump has sent warmest greetings to all Muslims observing the holy month of Ramadan. In a statement reads in part, "Throughout this month, we all have an opportunity to reflect on the blessings we have been given and to work toward greater fellowship with one another. Together, in the spirit of Ramadan, we can achieve a more harmonious and respectful society." Last Ramadan, President Trump hosted his first White House iftar dinner.
Tonight, as we enjoy a magnificent dinner at the White House, let us strive to embody the grace and goodwill that mark the Ramadan season.
While annual White House iftar dinners only began a few decades ago, Thomas Jefferson, the third American president, hosted the first iftar dinner in 1805 to welcome the Tunisian ambassador Suleiman Melimeli. Jefferson adjusted the timing of the state meal to after sunset to accommodate the Muslim ambassador's Ramadan tradition. Mohammed Al-Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up, the next threat to the Rohingya might come from the sky. You're listening to VOA Asia.
VOA Special English. A way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia. A suicide bomb explosion Wednesday morning outside a religious shrine in Pakistan's second largest city, Lahore, has killed at least 8 and wounded more than 20 others. The apparent target was a police vehicle near one of the gates of the shrine. At least 5 people, police personnel died in the attack, according to the Inspector General of Punjab Province. You're listening to VOA Asia. We continue now. United Nations aid workers say the Rohingya refugee camps in Bangladesh are at risk of landslides and flooding, with the cyclone season underway and the monsoon set to begin next month. The aid workers cite erosion and other problems. And Cox's Bazar reporter Dave Grunebaum looks at some of the steps being taken to prepare for the rainy season.
So it's just a matter of putting like a tarpaulin or a sandbag and carrying the water all the way out so it doesn't actually sit on that slope. You don't want it to sit on the slope.
Marina Drasba from the United Nations Refugee Agency is explaining to a Rohingya refugee that his family's shelter is at risk. It sits on a hill that is slowly being eroded by water and could eventually collapse. This is a common situation at Rohingya refugee camps. Marina Drasba says the problem will only grow with the start of the cyclone season and the monsoon season that follows.
We have landslide risk and we have flooding risks. We also have wind and storm surge risks in different parts of the camps. So I have to make sure that the population is aware of the risks and then what steps they could take to mitigate those risks.
Since August 2017, more than 700,000 Rohingya Muslims have fled Myanmar for southern Bangladesh because of a military campaign that UN investigators say had genocidal intent, accusations Myanmar denies. The refugees now live in overcrowded camps that are essentially unplanned cities. A big reason behind the risks here is that just 2 years ago, this area was all forest. But then the refugees poured in, chopping down trees and clearing out the hills to set up the bamboo shelters.
This was a rapid settlement, and so we're coming in retroactively, trying to retrofit drainage. We're trying to put in different measures to make sure that the slopes are stable. Now, if this has been a planned camp, then it would be much different, and then you can actually see more of a structure to it. As you can see behind me, it's not very structured. It's just random.
Refugees are adding sandbags. Worn down walls and roofs are being replaced. Community outreach teams are going across the camps and reading illustrated books out loud to groups of refugees to help them understand steps they can take if a strong storm approaches.
We learned that if 3 flags are raised, that means the wind is severe and we need to move to a safe place. And we should take enough dry food with us to last for at least 3 days.
There are still concerns that not enough steps have been taken to prepare for a potential cyclone that might strike the camps one day. Aid workers say camps are in low-lying areas, making these shelters more susceptible. Dave Grunebaum for VOA News, Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh.
This news alert from VOA Asia. North Korea's strike drill last week, at which leader Kim Jong-un oversaw the launch of rockets and at least one short-range ballistic missile, was regular and self-defensive. Those are the words according to the country's foreign ministry. You're listening to VOA Asia. Anti-Islam, racist, and homophobic rants on social media have forced several candidates from Australia's main political parties to withdraw from the election campaign ahead of the May 18th poll. One disgraced nominee for the centre-right Liberal Party had suggested Muslims wanted to overthrow the Australian government and bring in Sharia law. Another said Muslim immigration into Australia should be banned. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
In this election, several candidates have had to suddenly quit or disavow what they've said on social media in the past. Racist and sexist posts have resurfaced online. Australia's Liberal Prime Minister Scott Morrison has been quick to distance himself from three of his party's nominees.
Those comments are things that I don't share, that I don't accept, and I won't stand for.
Jessica Whelan is one of the Liberal candidates who was forced to quit. She's denied being responsible for a vulgar post that argued women who supported Islam should be mutilated and sold as slaves. But she does admit that she's posted racist comments.
A couple of years ago, I would have made some anti-Islamic posts. I'm not denying that.
Whelan is now running as an independent in the state of Tasmania. And a former Australian MP, Peter Slipper, thinks she may win because of her old social media posts.
A lot of Liberal voters, they would sympathise with that unacceptable sentiment that she has expressed. And I think that a lot of Labor voters would also sympathise with it.
None of the major parties have been immune. The opposition Labor has also dropped candidates because of their offensive jokes about rape, lesbians and Catholics. In the Northern Territory, a Labour nominee, Wayne Kernoth, resigned after it was revealed he'd previously posted an Islamic State-themed photo online and had also shared a bizarre conspiracy theory that claimed the world was controlled by a society of Jewish shape-shifting lizards. Most of these self-destructive posts weren't made recently, but have emerged at a time when they would cause maximum damage. One disgraced candidate said his political downfall was an important lesson for young people that your social media footprint will follow you. And despite being denounced, racism has become a reoccurring theme this election. Candidates with no history of saying or writing racist comments have had their posters desecrated with swastikas and other offensive symbols. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Singapore's parliament Wednesday passed laws to combat what they call fake news that will allow authorities to order the removal of online content despite fierce criticism from tech giants and rights groups. They give government ministers powers to order social media sites like Facebook and Twitter to put warnings next to posts authorities deem to be false and, in extreme cases, get them to take them down. If an action is judged to be malicious and damaging to Singapore's interest, companies could be hit with fines of up to £1 million, $375,000.
This is Science in a Minute.
In 1998, when Sterling Nesbitt was a 16-year-old high school junior, he took part in a dig expedition in New Mexico's Zuni Basin. During that dig, the budding young paleontologist found a unique and nearly complete skeletal fossil. Today, Nesbitt is now a paleontologist and an assistant professor at Virginia Tech. Nesbitt and his colleagues have recently determined that the fossil he had dug up over 20 years ago is actually an early and tiny relative of the mighty Tyrannosaurus rex. Scientists have determined that the dinosaur they name Susquehannas hazeleye stood nearly a meter high at its hips and was about 3 meters in length and weighed between 21 and 41 kilograms. Despite its diminutive size, Susquehannas hazeleye is said to have been much like its bigger cousin, a ferocious carnivore that ate a diet of small animals. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. Remember to get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud, download our podcast, and take VOA Asia with you. Our thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Thomas Blondet, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and the whole VOA Asia team, Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day.